You're listening to the Noir and Bizarre. I'm Katie Marquette. Today, we're going back in time. Ancient Egypt, the land of the pharaohs, a civilization of high art, elaborate funerary practices, and a complex spirituality. And of course, mummies. Preserving the bodies of the dead for the ka, the soul, to return. And did you know we have our very own mummy right here in Baltimore? Well, we actually have a few. But we're talking about one particular mummy today. A mummy named Mary.
Have you no respect for the dead?
Of course I do, but sometimes I'd rather like to join them.
You know how to whistle, don't you, Steve? You know how to whistle, don't you, Steve?
They're demons. They're demons.
Experience the excitement, the danger.
But it would be slightly more difficult to pull off now, though, don't you think?
Now, my knowledge of ancient Egypt is pretty limited. I immediately think of that scene in The Mummy, Brendan Fraser and Rachel Weisz wildly running through the sand on camels, being chased by an undead, pretty annoyed mummy in search of his long-lost love. So figuring my knowledge had something to be desired, I called in an expert.
I'm Lisa Anderson-Ju, and I am the Associate Curator for Art of the Mediterranean, 5th millennium BCE to 4th century CE, which essentially means ancient Egypt, the ancient Near East, Greece, and Rome. We have one of the best collections of Egyptian art here at the Walters because Henry Walters collected so much before he died in 1931. He had a special relationship with a dealer, Dick Ronkolekian, who was particularly interested in Egyptian antiquities. So we have divided our Egyptian installation, which is the biggest part of the ancient world galleries on view, into the Egyptian temple, the funerary art, which is where the mummies are, portraiture from that's given chronologically. The portraiture is from the Old Kingdom into the Greek period. And we also have sections on royal portraiture and daily life. When Henry Walters died in 1931 and bequeathed his collection to Baltimore, we didn't have a mummy. And apparently that was something that people would come and ask about and walk away deeply disappointed that there was no mummy at the Walters. So it was something that the early curators were very interested in getting an example of. This is what people associate ancient Egypt with. So we were very fortunate in 1941. The Metropolitan Museum in New York at first were willing to give us Mary, our mummy, on indefinite loan, but instead they exchanged it with us. So they gave it to us by exchange for a set of volumes on William T. Walters' East Asian ceramics collection and gave us the mummy for that. I think they were willing to do this because Henry Walters was their second vice president for many years up until his death, and he gave a lot of money to the excavations that were happening at the Met. So how did the mummy come to the Met? Many of the big museums in the country and in the world form a lot of their collections of antiquities through partage. So they will be granted concessions to excavate in foreign countries. This happened more, I should say, in the early 20th century, in the late 19th century. But they would be granted concessions to excavate, and the foreign institution would get to take part of the finds back to their home institution. So the Metropolitan Museum in New York, the Boston Museum of Fine Arts, the Louvre, they all formed big parts of their collections like that. Our mummy was excavated in Deir el-Bari, which is near modern Luxor in ancient Thebes, which was the capital of Egypt in the New Kingdom. It was excavated in 1931 in a group of intrusive burials at the Temple of Hatshepsut. So the Temple of Hatshepsut was built for the woman who reigned as pharaoh for a while in the New Kingdom around the 15th century BCE. Her funerary temple had gone out of use by the time our mummy, which is dated around 850 BCE, so it's about 3,000 years old. By the time our mummy was placed there, the funerary temple was no longer in use, so it's an intrusive burial. But this area of Deir el-Bari was still used for burials generally It was very popular as a religious site, I guess I would say, in the late period, which is when our mummy dates from. So this is the funerary temple of Hatshepsut. And then this is the metal terrace. And so a lot of this was filled in with dirt in the late period, 500 years after it was built. So the Metropolitan Museum excavation was conducted by Ambrose Lansing. The mummy itself went to the Met for 10 years. She was actually found nested within a sycamore coffin that was essentially undecorated except for the face. It's not unusual to have examples of nesting coffins around the mummy as additional forms of protection. Basically, the more important you are, you might say, the more layers to your coffin you would have. Like, Tutankhamun had many layers to his coffin, and we're fortunate that the Met has also lent us some nesting coffins that we have on display next to Mary. The 5th century BCE author Herodotus, who was a Greek, but he wrote extensively on Egypt in his histories, and much of what he writes about mummification we think is still pretty accurate. He talks about three different levels of mummification. There's the more expensive, which takes 70 days, and he says that they would take a metal hook and pull your brain out through your nose, and then you would be eviscerated, and they would take out the stomach, intestines, lungs, and liver and place them in canopic jars. The heart would sometimes be left in place, or it would be removed and put back because they thought that was the seat of intelligence. And in the afterlife, you would have your heart judged against the feather of Mott, of truth, in front of Osiris, who ruled over the realm of the dead. So we don't actually know what her real name was. It's very common in Egyptian funerary practice to include the name. This is part of how you would make sure that the spirit received the offerings that it needed, that it was able to go into stone sculpture. The stone sculpture should have the name of the deceased. In this case, we're not sure whether there was some kind of temporary shrine structure that hasn't survived that would have had her name, or if there was some sort of tag on the mummy that would have had her name. But what we are sure of is that her name would have been somewhere associated with the mummy and that we've lost it. So the name Mary comes in because in 2008, a group from the Walters Art Museum and the University of Maryland School of Medicine did CT scanning on the mummy. And they gave her the name Mary at that point, M-E-R-Y, and it means the beloved in the language that was used in her time in the late period. So what they did find is that Mary was a woman who was between 50 and 60 years old, that she was particularly short for her time. She was under 5 feet tall, that she had at least 16 tooth abscesses. And so it's possible that she died of septicemia related to the abscesses in her teeth. One of her teeth had a resin prosthetic that may have helped her. It wouldn't have helped with the abscesses, but maybe it helped alleviate the pain or helped her to chew. They did note that she seemed especially thin, so it's possible that she wasn't eating well before she died. They also found that she had extensive osteoarthritis. Cartonnage is linen and plaster with painted designs over it. In this case, it is mummiform, human-shaped, with a human head with protective symbols on the top, a wig, and then various registers of decoration, including funerary symbols, as well as like a scene showing the laying out of a deceased with the canopic jars underneath. We don't think that the cartonnage was made to fit her, and there are a couple reasons why that could be. She could have died too quickly to have her own custom cartonnage made. She's at least 6 inches shorter than the cartonnage. So one thing that we like to say in tours is perhaps they wanted her to appear taller in the afterlife. So the afterlife, you would need all the things in the afterlife that you had in this world, but you still needed to be able to come into this world. There's this liminal aspect to it, going back and forth. We have a wooden coffin on view, square box, basically, rectangular box, with eyes on the sides, and the deceased would look out through those eyes into the real world. And many tomb structures have doors, so ways of entering, but you also need to be able to enter the body or enter into statues. So many of the statues have the names of the person so that the spirits could access that and also receive offerings and hear the rituals that way. Part of, I think, our fascination with mummies is the idea that they are supposed to be reanimated. We know that they are hungry, they need food offerings, and the entire point is that they are meant to be brought back to life and come into our world. So what you see in the mummy movies of the mummy trying to go and eat people. I don't actually know what mummies do. And just the idea that they are so well preserved as well. And mummy unwrapping parties were very popular in the Victorian period. In fact, our child mummy in the Chamber of Wonders is actually a long-term loan from Gaucher College. They were brought from Egypt in 1895, that mummy, and one that's in Johns Hopkins right now on view. And the Baltimore Sun from 1895 has a description of the mummy unwrapping party for the one that's on display at Johns Hopkins, and how they really only got partway through before it got quite tedious and they decided to stop. You have to think the mummy is not only enclosed in really interesting decorations, and ours is not opened. We haven't opened the cartonnage. That's one of the reasons why we had to do the CT scan. But you take off the cartonnage, and then you have the wrapped mummy in linen. And then as you're unwrapping the linen, there are all these protective amulets inside. So it's a little bit of a surprise how well preserved it's going to be. So there's this sense of anticipation. What are you going to see when you get down to the actual body? The ways that mummies were used before the modern era is a bit shameful. There's famously Mummy Brown, which was a paint that was used by the pre-Raphaelites. And Mark Twain, I hope it's a joke, but he talks about mummies being used to fuel a train.
I guess once a certain amount of time has passed, it's like, sorry, you are an artifact now.
Yeah, they talked about how there were just so many mummies in Egypt, like they were quite plentiful. I think the wrappings were even used in making paper at some point. It was just so much more simple to go get a mummy to use it for something else than to get the natural resources. I don't know.
I think we have this concept of like you have to go find a mummy, and it's like quite an endeavor. You know, you picture people going down into tombs, but and ancient Egypt was so well preserved, it makes sense that there were just, you know, everybody gets a mummy. So
you get a mummy. You get a mummy.
Before we wrapped up our interview, I wanted to make sure to ask Lisa the question on everyone's mind, at least everyone who's ever seen a mummy movie. Does Mary care that her eternal rest has been disturbed?
I've only been at the Walters for a little over a year now, so I haven't experienced any Mary-related hauntings. But I do have a theory about that. Perhaps since she lost her name, she lost her connection. Her ka can no longer inhabit her mummy. So we might be safe from Mary in particular, but you know, I would avoid some of the named mummies at the Metropolitan Museum, for instance.
So there you have it. How lucky are we here in Baltimore to have access to this amazing collection of artifacts from the ancient world? If you haven't, swing by the Walters Art Museum and visit Mary. And while you're there, check out the newly renovated One West Mount Vernon Place, the adjoining 19th century mansion. Our cultural institutions bring us such amazing insights into fantastic and bizarre worlds, connecting us with people from the past. I mean, how incredible is it that Mary was in a tomb in Egypt, buried 3,000 years ago. And now here she is at the Walters Art Museum in Baltimore City, Maryland in 2018. This is incredible to me. And I guess I struggle a bit with how to view mummies, because before they were in art collections, they were in tombs, carefully prepared by their families, and meant to last them an eternity. I guess what I'm saying is, I hope we'll continue to respect and learn about Mary. And let's hope that Mary's resting place at the Walters continues to be a welcoming one. And I know she'll appreciate your visit. The Noir and Bizarre is an original WYPR production, hosted and produced by me, Katie Marquette. Until next time, thanks for listening.